Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Good morning, everybody, or good afternoon, good evening, whatever you're listening to this. Welcome to another episode of Knife Talk. It's 6 o'clock in the morning for me, so that's why I'm saying good morning. I am Mareko Malmasi. Normally, I'm here with Jeff Fader of Fader Knives, but as always, I'm here with the ever faithful Mr. Craig Lockwood, rock and roll star of the Knife Makers. We're here to keep you company in the shop, to answer your questions, to help share in the burdens of struggle and all that good stuff. And so, but first we'd like to, before we get into it, we're going to start off with just a little recap of last week. So Craig, how's the last week been for you?
Good. Yeah, so it's 3 p.m. for me, so I'm a little bit more awake. This week, what's been going on? I can't even think what's been going on this week. We've had my youngest turn 2 just yesterday.
That's exciting.
So there's been lots of excitement in the house with the older girls who are 5, thinking they're planning everything and so on. So it's been, aside from that, I'm trying to think what else has gone on this week. It's flown by. It seems as if it was literally yesterday we were chatting, you know? and I think last time, had I made the trip back to France last time? I think we were planning it. I was planning it, wasn't I?
Yeah.
So we did the long-ass 18-hour drive back from Wales back home to France here. And that always takes 2 or 3 days out of me when I get back. Because we don't split it up, we literally do 18 hours. So it's a full day sleeping the next day, and the next day I'm groggy. So it takes 2 or 3 days. And then we were straight into planning Buddy's birthday yesterday. So it's not much has really happened, although it seems as if a lot. Does that make sense?
No. I mean, with 3 little ones in the house, I can imagine time just disappears.
Yeah, I've been busy, but I haven't done anything, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've just been quietly frustrated in the corner. Yeah, that's been my week. What about yourself?
What is going on? Oh, last week I was struggling with that knife, but I think I salvaged it. I think I pulled it together. I actually sent a little video clip to you.
I did see it. It looks pretty awesome, I've got to say.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I got it. I got the fixes made, and I sent a clip actually to the customer too, and they're good with the changes and everything's looking good to them. They're very excited. So that's totally best case scenario. So the next steps on that thing are just, to start working on hand sanding and get the actual handle on there. It has some dummy scales on it because I'm going to be doing it, what's called a museum fit up. So that means that the handle scales are just slightly proud of it by like maybe, I don't know, half a millimeter. And then you kind of bevel the edges. So it has this kind of, I don't know, this aesthetic to it. Really, more than anything, it's just a pain in the ass to do that knife makers have started to do in the last, maybe 5 or 10 years. But I think the idea around it is that it helps to adapt the potential of handle material swelling or shrinkage potentially swelling. Shrinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if it's already slightly larger than the hardware, then any kind of small movement either direction is actually not really going to be noticed.
There's going to be loads of shitty knife makers now going, okay, that's done. yeah. It's a bit more to it than that, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So like I said, I have dummy handle scales on there, or temporary scales, basically so I could sculpt, because it's an integral, it's a full integral. So the blade, the guard, the full tang are all forged out of one piece of stainless mosaic Damascus. And then, so I had to sculpt the guard and everything, and get the tang all cleaned up to a pretty high finish before I even go and put on and temporarily attach the actual finish scales that are going to go on it. So on there right now are just like some micarta, cheap micarta scales that I got. But I'm going to be putting on a really beautiful piece of like an ironwood burl onto the handle scales.
Nice.
And it's going to look really nice, but it's, again, I have to temporarily attach them, do some sculpting, make sure I don't take it all the way down to the steel around the guard and the tang, then take them back off, hand sand the blade, mark the blade, etch the blade, make it look nice, and then put the handle scales back on for a final glue up.
Jeez. I've got a question for you regarding the video. You said you sent the video to the client.
Yeah.
So all your work is pretty much custom, isn't it? Pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, I rarely am doing customs anymore, but this is one, like I said, it's been kind of on the books for a couple of years now, and I'm finally getting it finished up.
So at what points, I mean, do you make that up a thing where at various points you'll send them a video? Because it's got to be easier than doing like the full reveal at the end, them saying, oh, I didn't quite want it like that.
Yeah.
So, do you do it at various points throughout the build stage?
I typically do. Especially like I'll check in with the customer after I forge the pattern and the blade, and then I have a reveal of the pattern just to make sure that they're happy with it. Because at that point the pattern is what it's going to look like. And so as long as the customer's like, yay, that looks great, then I keep moving forward. And so, probably like the handle assembly or the rough sculpting, I'll send another video at that point. And then as long as I'm still getting positive feedback, I'll keep moving forward. And then basically I do the final reveal. So I really only touch base like a few times throughout the build, but it's usually they're points that have been pain points in the past with previous customers.
Yeah. Yeah,
and so that's why I'm like, I don't want that to happen again. So I'm going to touch base with the customer now to make sure that everything's looking good.
Instead of going too far down the wrong road. Yeah, exactly. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I had
a customer one time several years ago. They wanted a colorful handle. So they said they wanted blue. And I searched around the internet. I found a block that I thought looked really great. I sent them pictures of a few different varieties of blocks, all blue. And they picked one that they liked. And I sent them pictures. I had been sending pictures of it along the way because I was like, I actually thought it was cool and I was excited to share it with them. And they're like, yeah, that looks great. I even sent them finished pictures and then they got it. And then I followed, I mailed it out. They got it. I never heard anything back, which I hate. Probably because I'm always looking for that, you know, that positive feedback. And so, and the approval. And it took about a week or two to hear back from them, and they're like, "Yeah, you know, the handle material's a lot brighter or louder." I think they said it's louder than I thought it was going to be. I'm like, "What the fuck, you dingbat? You fucking picked it out? God damn it!" And so they were like super unhappy with it. They ended up selling that knife on the secondary market, like not long after that. And I'm like, "Whatever." It ended. Yeah. I thought it was great, but. Whatever. What is it? I just heard recently on the internet that the customer is always right is actually only a portion of a longer quote, which is the...
Really? Alright. Because everybody knows that quote, yeah.
Yeah, I guess the original quote is, the customer is always right in matters of taste. So I guess at that point, that for his taste, that he was right about that. But when it comes to the customer is always right about anything else, is actually based
taken
off
out of context a bit. Yeah.
An abbreviated, yeah, quote. Sorry, yeah. Brain's still waking up a little bit.
6 a.m., that'll do it, yeah.
Yeah.
So we need to say where Jeff is, actually. So, I think he's pretty brave. So I see a lot lately, men of a certain age getting hair transplants. And I think maybe 5 or 6 years ago, you would never have seen people as sort of admitting that online and stuff like that. But I'm seeing lots of people, you know, taking us on their hair transplant journey, and they'll show pictures before and after and things like that. So, good luck to Jeff. Hope it all goes well. And we hope to see some finished weaves at the end. It'd be nice to see.
Oh, my God.
But he should be back next week, and hopefully, you know, the scars won't be there visible in his next Instagram shots. But if they are, just make a little note on his Instagram saying, we can't see the scars. They've done a good job. I'm sure you'll be happy with that. Okay, shall we get on with the show?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. Well, okay, first of all,
Knife Talk is sponsored by Even Heat, the manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com.
We've got lots and lots of questions in, which Jeff has kindly put in the notes for us. This first one is from Maestro BMX. I have a question to podcast about handstanding with diamond paste. I heard that some people use diamond and oil solution to speed up hand sanding, especially for very hard steels. I know it can be used with leather straps to finish the edge while sharpening, to finish the edge while sharpening. But I'm not sure how to use it to remove scratches made by a belt grinder. Should I use a hard backing? Should I use sandpaper as well? And if yes, how then should I adjust grit size to diamond particle size? Never heard of anybody doing that, but that does make a sense, you know, having some sort of abrasion in the any sort of liquid that you're using, or some sort of, yeah, it does make sense, but I've never heard of it before. Have you ever done anything like that at all?
I've never done anything like that, and I think the concern for me would be with the diamond paste that it's a loose abrasive. It's powder in a paste, and it slides around wherever you want, so it's kind of hard to control whether it's actually staying underneath your hand sanding stick or not to get the work done. I have heard of people using, and this was a long time ago, but people using or making their own diamond abrasive sanding pads. So basically using some sort of abrasive. I don't remember what it was exactly. And diamond powder. And then it would do its thing to cure. And then you would have a sanding stick, essentially, with diamond abrasive on it. That sounds like it's expensive, honestly, more than anything, and a big pain in the ass. In my experience, some of the most wear-resistant steel I've ever had to do any hand finishing on was Crewforge V. I've never had to do some of these other carbide volume boutique steels. But the Crewforge V was a beast, and I've heard it even from people who've worked with some of the other crazy ones that are really wear resistant, that it's also just a pain in the ass. And so what I've used in the past was Norton Black Ice. It's a sheet sandpaper, and it comes in a sheet just like any other sandpaper. And I can't remember what kind of abrasive or what kind of like abrasive it is, whether it's silicon carbide. I think it's some sort of silicon carbide, but I don't know. But it's the only thing that I found that was really effective in getting a good hand sand finish on a hardened piece of highly wear-resistant steel. The diamond abrasive sounds like there might be something to it, but it also sounds like a lot more than I'm willing to do. So I would probably just slog it out with a good abrasive of some sort.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds as if it could get messy as well. So when I very first started, I was always wet sanding and putting lots of liquid on there, and you know, just because it feels as if it's easier. But yeah, eventually the mess that it was making and everything, I just went to just going completely dry. Everything's a lot more visible then, so you can see where you're going with regards to, you know, any stroke lines, that kind of thing, J-hooks. Yeah. So yeah, it sounds like it could be messy. But I mean, we're always getting similar questions. People are looking for shortcuts, aren't we, to hand sanding. Last week we had this machine, somebody said, is this any good, which was some sort of fucking machine, as Jeff called it. But unfortunately, I think really that it's just elbow grease, really, isn't it? I mean, what can you do? You can get some good sandpaper and, you know, The best out there is Indasa Rhino Wet, which we all use. Cut them into little strips, sort of inch-long strips, inch-wide strips, rather. Personally, I'd use a hard backing and then maybe get some backings with a bit of leather as well to give a bit of give as well, so you've got the choice. But yeah, Indasa Rhino Wet is the shit. You can get that from TexasFarrowSupply.com. They do everything at Texas Fire Supply, not just Indasa Rhino Wet. But if you use Knife Talk 10, you get 10% off your full order from Texas Fire Supply. So go get some Indasa Rhino Wet. If you haven't used it yet, honestly, it'll change your life when it comes to hand sanding. And yeah, that's at TexasFireSupply.com. Unfortunately, there isn't really, that I'm aware of, any easy way. There's no machine that's going to do the work for you there.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to jump down farther in the list. I saw a few weeks back when I wasn't here that there were a bunch of questions that were like around Damascus and forging.
Give me the Damascus questions. Come on, I'm up for it.
This one actually isn't Damascus, but it's buried. So this one's okay, so this one's from Noah Rocklin. He says, "Hey y'all, I have a question about decarb. I work with mostly 1084 and some other carbon steels. I keep hearing people talking about decarb almost as if it's the same thing as scale. Is this the case, that the scale on the blade is the decarb layer, or are they two different things? If I'm right in thinking they are different, how does one know how thick the layer of decarb is? Is there a visible cue that informs you when you have ground through the decarb? Thanks. Love the podcast, Noah." All right, so what's your take?
So, I'll go first with that. I personally just use stainless from now on, and you haven't got to worry about that problem. Mareka, what would you do?
All right, so for the carbon steels, the forge scale and the decarb are related, but they are two different things. The forge scale is it's kind of a result of the decarb. Although the decarb, actually, maybe they're not necessarily linked, but they're linked in the fact that they are a result from high exposure to high temperatures. Mm. So the forge scale is iron oxide, and so most anything that exists in the world oxidizes in some way. Even beers oxidize when they're exposed to oxygen for too long, and they develop kind of a bitter metallic kind of flavor to them, and it's off-putting, and same with wines and other kind of things. All kinds of foods, all things in the world, oxygen is the great deteriorator of all things. It's the thing that gives us life or helps us exist, but it also destroys everything at the same time. And so it is oxygen at high temperatures leaching onto the steel and forming a crusty layer on the outside of the steel. But it is not exactly the same thing as the decarb. So the scale on the outside can be cleaned off, but you still have decarburization along the skin or the top surface of the steel, in the steel. But it's a thin layer, and it's usually about, in my experience, it's like maybe 10, 20 thousandths at the thickest. But it really depends on the time and how much... how much time it's been allowed to spend at really high temperatures. But it always it doesn't go deeper and deeper into the material. It stays at about that 10, 20 thousandths of an inch because the carbon is moving around within the iron matrix of the crystals and the steel and everything. It's moving around, so it only stays at the surface, that decarburization, until you start to, if you just let it sit there and roast for a really long time at high temperatures, you're going to deplete the steel of carbon, and then, that carbon... the decarb layer is going to go deeper and deeper into the steel at that point. But through normal forging, whether you're making Damascus, actually, if you're making Damascus at any point, or you have just an extra scrap of steel, have it laying around and kind of play with it at, pull it in and out of the forge, alongside a blade that you might be forging. So every time you pull out the blade, pull out the little chunk, little coupon, and then over time, then go kind of like check it out, cut through it or clean it up so you can see that decarb layer. And it looks, you can see it best with ferric. So whether you take the scale off or not, if you cut, if you, you know, you put a little bar in there, you cut it in half, clean it up to at least, you know, like a 120 or 220 finish, you can dip it in some ferric and you will see this light, like white cloudy edge, this silver lining around the outside layer of the steel, while the middle of it will probably be kind of like gray, light gray or whatever. And that's going to be your decarb layer. If you are finished grinding a knife, you forged the blade, you got the forged scale off. This is more, honestly, this is more pertinent with Damascus than it is with monosteel knives. But even with monosteel, if you're grinding along and everything looks clean, if you want to make sure that there's no decarb, dip it in some ferric. You'll start seeing these bright areas, like these bright cloudy areas. Those are decarb versus darker areas that are going to be your kind of like your carbon rich or your good material that's below the decarb layer. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that'll be the same thing in Damascus. I remember the first time I ever saw this, I was like, I had no idea what it was. I forged out a great Damascus blade. I cleaned it up. I did all the finish grinding, and then I went to etch it, and I had this big blob, like the size of like a silver dollar or a quarter, of like this bright material. I could still see the pattern, but I was like, what the fuck is this? It was just like this cloud that was looming over kind of like the rest of the pattern. And it finally dawned on me that it might be decarb, and I'd never seen it before. So I went in and I basically ground deeper, dug it out with my grinding, and finally got through it. And I was like, holy shit, I have to be careful about grinding or forging too close to my finish dimension, because I need to account for that decarb layer that I have to grind through. Now, that was before I started doing any kind of S grind work. So now I'm less concerned about it because it gets dug out anyways. But, you know, around the ricasso and around the bolster and the spine, like all those areas, you still have to take that in consideration when you're forging a blade, so that you kind of build in a little bit of a buffer zone in all dimensions to make sure that you're getting through that down to clean material, especially for Damascus, so that you have a clean etch on your knife. Now you might be doing it on purpose. Some people do that, and I think it actually is a cool look. Adam Derosiers is a friend of mine out of Alaska. He's a very talented forger and well-known knife maker, master smith, and he forges his blades really close to finish dimension, and it creates kind of like a sandmai aesthetic to it. So he's doing his finish grinding. He's getting through the decarb along the edge, but because he's forged it so close to shape, there's some kind of residual decarb along the blade. He usually does this in monosteel, like W2 or Crewforge V or something like that.
So it would look like an edge quench, wouldn't you, to get this?
Yeah, well, it looks like sandmai. It looks like there's cladding, but what it is it's decarburized material that's remaining on the blade, and it's such a cool look. And so I call it, I can't even remember what I used to call it. But when I would talk to him, I would just call it like decarb, sandmai decarb, or the decarb. I can't remember. Sorry, terrible story. Anyways, it's a cool look. If you go check out his Instagram, I think he's Derosiers Knives or Derosier Adam on Instagram. And if you don't know how that's spelled, it's Derosiers. It's a French last name.
There we go.
Derosiers.
The Josier.
Yeah.
Okay, MRC knives, sup boys. I've only been actually making knives for 3 months, so this may be a rookie question, but I'm trying to learn as much as possible. How the hell do I shape handles with brass inlays without degrading my epoxy and the scales falling apart? He says, I absolutely love the podcast. It's been a huge factor in my skill progression. So I'm trying to picture what he means here. So he says brass inlays. So I'm not sure whether he means brass pins, whether he's using Corby bolts, or whether he actually means like brass liners on a full tang knife. And I think, from my experience of having done that, I think he probably means it like a brass liner on a full tang. Mm. So the answer, if that is the case, it's very, very difficult. I did it once with like an ebony-like wood, so you get that huge contrast of black with a beautiful sort of almost golden brass liner. Looks beautiful, but it's a hell of a lot of work, particularly if you're using, you know, really thin brass. So generally what I was doing is, first of all, you need to make sure you get everything cut down as close to finish size as possible. You want to be grinding as little as possible once things are glued up. Because brass, unfortunately, it'll just take all that heat from grinding, and it'll just keep that heat there. So any yeah. epoxy you've got is going to start running out and just not being, become sort of gummy and not hold as it should. So what I do is, when I was doing brass inlays, is basically make as many holes in that as possible. That's doing two things. It's sort of dropping the amount of mass of brass that's there. Mass of brass, wow. And it's also allowing epoxy to make these like little sort of plugs, I suppose. If you're using wooden scales or whatever scales you may do, I generally put dimples on the inside as well, making sure you're going nowhere near the finished edge of what you're gonna grind down to. And this is all just giving you those extra little pockets of epoxy. But yeah, the main thing is make sure that brass is as close to finished dimension as possible. Use new abrasives all the time on brass, so it's as sharp as it possibly can be. That'll help with any sort of heat generation. And then you've just got to take it as slow as possible. I'd always try and make sure you use some sort of mechanical fixing as well. So if you're using brass liners, it's some brass Corby bolts would mm-hmm. go well as well.
Yeah.
But obviously a thin brass, it's very actually hard to cut that and to drill that without deforming its shape as well.
Right.
If you're using really thin brass. So what I generally do there is get two pieces of wood, clamp them together with the brass in the middle.
Oh, that's a good move.
And then when you're drilling, the brass isn't going anywhere. It's almost sandwiched between two harder pieces. So take out as much brass as you can. So you're literally leaving, an edge if possible, almost like skeletonize the brass that's, the bits that's hidden. Use good epoxy, good sharp abrasives, take your time, and some sort of mechanical fixing as well, such as a Corby bolt, and you should be good. But that's assuming that I've got the question right, that you're talking about using, you say brass inlays, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. Assuming you mean liners, or if you're talking pins even, I generally try and use bolts rather than pins because the finished result looks exactly the same. But you've got that extra precaution of, a mechanical fixing rather than just a brass pin, which, to be honest with you, would be fine anyway, I'm pretty sure. But if you're taking off a lot of brass, it's going to generate a lot of heat, so just be careful.
Yeah, so when I worked for Bob Kramer, his handle assembly is two Corby bolts, one at the top of the handle, or top of the scale, and one at the bottom of the scale. And in the middle was a mosaic pin, which is what I was taking the inlay to be. Because there are all kinds of people selling mosaic pins nowadays, especially like EDM cut. You can do your own like initial or emblem or whatever on the inside of the thing. But when I first started doing the handle sculpting, I learned very quickly that what you were talking about, that how quickly brass conducts heat and it can really mess with the epoxy. And when we would put the mosaic, because we would make the mosaic pins ourselves because they're pretty simple, and then we would the handle scales were probably an inch and a quarter or inch and an eighth overall thickness, so the actual mosaic pin was maybe like inch and a half. So, and it was chamfered on one side, so it's easy to use, like, I can't remember what it's called, but we could push it in and get it into the handle, no problem. But the problem was, if I left the pin long and I tried to use the grinder to grind it down, if it was just sharp, like a fresh belt, it would probably be fine. But the reality is, you probably don't want to use a fresh belt to just grind down a pin. So I was usually using kind of a somewhat used or worn out belt, and that friction from that worn out belt transferred into the brass and then into the glue so fucking fast. It was just melting out epoxy and making a giant mess and totally honestly ruining the pin, which made me have to destroy the handle, take it all apart and put it all back together again.
Yeah. Particularly if you're using a mosaic, because quite often that
there's a lot of
that stuff in the middle is a lot of resin epoxy.
Yeah.
Is it epoxy or resin?
Yeah.
And also if you're using a lighter wood as well, that heat that is on the brass can actually burn the surrounding
wood
bolts. As well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I've done that too. Yeah. So I've learned that as best as you can, trim that down. If your pin is longer than your forge scales, trim it down as close as you can with a saw or by hand or whatever you got to do. Trim it down. Even if they're little eighth inch brass pins or whatever pins, you want to trim those down too. So you're doing as little grinding as possible. And then when you're sculpting the handle, use sharp abrasives and take breaks every once in a while. Actually, when I worked with Bob, because they were brass Corby bolts and the brass mosaic pin in the middle, he would dip the whole handle in water to quench those pins, to cool, because he would grind, quench it, and then grind, quench it. Because realistically, if you're just cooling it really quick for even like whatever 10 seconds, that water isn't penetrating into either a dense resin wood like Cocobolo, which he uses a lot, or a acrylicized stabilized handle. It's not going deep into that wood in that 10 seconds. You'd have to soak it for a really long time for it to really pick up and draw that moisture deep into the handle scales. So, yeah. But at the end of, so in your rough shaping, say through 60 grit or even 120 grit, you might do that. But once you get to the 220, you probably want to stop having to dip the handle into water. But while that was something we did, that is not something I do anymore. I do everything I can to prevent the handle material from being exposed to unnecessarily exposed to moisture as best as I can. Of course, if you have a synthetic handle, that doesn't matter. If you're doing like Micarta or whatever, G10, whatever, you're good to go. You can quench that all day. And so, yeah, my biggest advice is sharp abrasives. And if you can, cool it off somehow. Even having compressed air like next to you with like a blower nozzle, I've used that to help cool things down. If I'm not comfortable with like cooling off with water, I'll use the blower nozzle with compressed air to cool things off. But yeah, you got to keep it cool. Otherwise, it's just going to, every time it's going to burn up that epoxy and start deteriorating it. I mean, the epoxy, most epoxies and glues, and I think you've done more learning on epoxies and glues, but they start to deteriorate at a low temperature or somewhat low temperature around 250 to 275 degrees at the earliest. And then, once you hit 350, like that stuff, it's garbage.
Yeah, it becomes all gummy, and it's not nice. And a lot of people may think, well, why would I bother using brass then? Why not use stainless? But that comes with its own problems then. Yeah. So, for example, if you're using a wooden handle, or I did a lot of sort of epoxy-based handles as well, actually. Right. When you start grinding, let's say it's a stainless pin down, that stainless is a lot harder than the handle material.
Right.
And you tend to get these bumps and lumps. So, So I can understand why people would prefer to use brass. I mean, I do too. But yeah, it's all about just sharp abrasives, taking your time. It's going to generate heat. Take that time. Sharp abrasives, if you're going to use abrasives, obviously.
Combat Abrasives makes the world's best abrasive belts for knife makers. Available in any size at unbelievable prices. Go take a look at combatabrasives.com and get 15% off with promo code KNIFETALK15. Do it now!
15%. I think we sort of gloss over that sometimes, but 15% is a hell of a saving. So. Yeah. Yeah, make sure you head over to combatabrasives.com. Every grit you could possibly need. And lots of manufacturers as well. So, take a look and maybe try something different as well, because you may stumble across something and you think, oh, God, this has changed everything for me. So,
sure.
Yeah, 15% off is a good old
absolutely.
Saving.
I will add one more thing. It's not just I don't want people to think it's just brass or stainless steel or something. This is all metal pins. Just that grinding is going to, whether it's copper, bronze, brass, nickel, silver, it could be what even, I don't even remember what I was going to say. But anyway, what I was going to say is even like a G10 pin is going to be wear resistant than especially if you're putting like a G10 pin into wood or something like that. You got to be careful because that friction, especially if the belt's not fresh, it's going to create a lot of friction, which creates heat, and that's going to transfer into the wood or into the epoxy, and it's going to cause bad things to happen. Especially if you're trying to rely on that glue, the little bit of glue that is in there with that pin, that heat again is going to start to deteriorate that glue, and you're going to be basically working against it and destroying it. So
yeah, get yourself one of those little metal band saws. They're not expensive, and just trim down as much as you can beforehand, so there's less grinding to go on. Yeah.
All right, I got another Damascus one from lower on the list. It's from Rick Elm. It says, "Hey cuties, when making a sand my blade from 15 and 20 and 1084, how do you achieve a clean etch using the ferric acid and later the coffee etch method? I find that I always get what I can only describe as a dark haze in the 15 and 20. Am I over etching? Do I need to use fine grit sandpaper, then re-etch? Do I need to use gator piss? Any help would be appreciated. I always love the podcast and your commitment to passing on your knowledge." Okay, so what do you think, Craig?
This is all you, Mareko.
Oh.
Let's not even cloud people's opinions with my stupid judgment here.
Okay. My first question would be, if this was coming straight to me, like through my Patreon or something, would be, how bold is your pattern? Send me a picture of your pattern. Let me figure out how bold it is. Because I have found pretty consistently across various etches that if the pattern is bolder than about an eighth of an inch, maybe a quarter of an inch at the most, but usually about an eighth of an inch, the silver portions of the pattern, if any of the lines get wider than about an eighth of an inch, they will start to pick up kind of a cloudy haziness, especially in the coffee. And why that is, I don't really know. But it happens. And so if you have a really bold, like I've seen some really bold random patterns, really bold twists, ladders, whatever, and they have kind of like this haziness. I've even seen it in my own patterns where once it gets broader, or that 15 and 20 portion, if any of those lines get broader than about an eighth of an inch, it starts to pick up that coloration. And it's just something that happens, and I don't know if there's really any way around it. I will say that when I do the coffee etch, I etch in ferric, but only to check the cleanliness of the blade, to make sure I didn't like leave a thumbprint on it, or there isn't any weird acetone residue from cleaning any oil or whatever off on the blade, because acetone will leave a residue. And I've had that issue in the past where it leaves when it goes to etch, it acts as a partial resist, and there's these streaks going down the length of the blade. It's terrible. You have to rehand sand the blade, and everything is a huge pain in the ass. So I dip the blade in ferric just to make sure it's clean. And it's only for like maybe 20 seconds. It's only a quick dip just to make sure it's clean. If I pull the blade out and I have an even bite all over the blade, there aren't any weird issues, then I
say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
I neutralize the blade and then I scrub it clean with my rubber abrasives that you can find on Amazon and stuff like that. They're usually sold as fret erasers. I like to play at least the 220 grit level or higher. But these fret erasers are used for on guitars for cleaning up frets, because from finger oils or exposure to moisture or different humidity in rooms, frets on guitars will start to corrode or build up kind of like a whatever gunkiness on them. So anyways, I use that to clean up the blade after the fair catch, after it's been neutralized. And then from there, I go into the coffee and I let it do its coffee thing, and I check it every whatever half an hour or something, especially if I'm doing the cold etch. I check it every half an hour, 40 minutes, because it does usually take a little bit longer, but I usually get a much better result, more durable result than a ferric etch. I have been thankfully, to Maritime Knife Supply, I got some gator piss, and I've been working with it and kind of working out a process for etching with it. It does require a little bit more work, especially when it comes to the upfront grind or like polishing of the blade and the hand sanding. You got to kind of take it to a higher grit, and then they also, I think on the bottle, it advises to polish the blade as well. But you see people like JB Blades and others are getting awesome results on carbon steel Damascus out of the gator etch, and but I think you still would want to do the same thing. You would want to do a quick etch in the ferric just to make sure it's clean. For me anymore, the ferric is just for checking cleanliness of the blade, and then from there, as long as the blade surface is clean, you can go forward. If the blade surface isn't, then you hand wash it or whatever you got to do to clean it off, and you check it again, and you keep doing that until the whole surface of the blade is clean, it's getting an even etch in the ferric. Then you do one final clean off of any ferric oxides, and then go into whatever your final etch is going to be. Maybe it's going to be the ferric again, honestly. I would even do it before the ferric etch. If I was only doing ferric etch, I would still do a test etch to make sure it's all clean. But I do it before the gator etch, ferric, or coffee, to make sure that everything's good to go so that the final etch goes as smoothly as possible. I would also, when it comes to making your coffee etch, or honestly, any etch, like the ferric, usually diluting with water. The coffee, you're obviously making with water, especially if you're making it from the Nescafe crystals. Use distilled water. And this is advice that I got from Steve Schwarzer, which is, I don't know why I never thought of this before. But when using distilled water, you're eliminating any variables that might be coming out of your well water, out of the tap water, or any of that kind of
any minerals any, that may yeah, be in it. Yeah.
Any weird minerality that might be in there doing something funky to the acids that you're trying to put to work. So by using distilled water, you eliminate those variables. So that's one less thing you're guessing at. So if you continue to have some sort of issue, at least you know it's not the water, because that's the constant throughout all the different mixtures or dilution ratios and stuff like that you're messing with.
Nice.
And so that's what I got.
Cool. That's a very deep answer. Okay. I'll take one from Adele Knives. Hey guys, have you got any tips on decorative file work on handles and spines, please? Mm. Do you prefer freehand or do you use a machine? He says, feel free to look the knife I posted. It was my first attempt at file work, and I definitely have room for improvement. So firework, I always do some sort of, well, it's quite basic firework, just because I think it does look nice. I've tried using a machine, so it didn't work out. So by hand, you can use a machine. So I'd use a rotary machine, and you can get these tiny little ends, which are almost like, they're like little cones. And what I'd do is just hit that spine at 45 degrees with that little cone, and it would give you a nice little sort of scalloped edge. And you could sort of alternate them and make a little pattern. But what you find with the rotary machine is that it wants to sort of skate along the edge because it's turning. Mm. So I'd get a pack of sort of diamond files. They're not that expensive, but you do generally go through quite a few of them. Because I'm sure if you bought more expensive ones, maybe they'd last longer. But I think generally they clog up; they're not too good. But I'd mark out my spine. So I'd use some engineer's fluid, that blue-in fluid, color the spine, use some sort of edge to make your marks where you want to make those indents on your spine. And first of all, start with a square edged, a triangular or a square edged file. Just to get that bite that you need. So you're using that, as I say, like a chisel edge. Take it 45 degrees and just get that bite that you need to get things going. Mm-hmm. Once you've got things going, you can then round off then. If rounding off is the pattern that you want, sometimes you may want that triangular bite out of the spine. If you want it to be rounded, you can then use a round. I wouldn't really start with a rounded file to begin with. Always get that initial bite with a triangular or a square file. Once you've got the bite, then you can take the round in and you can round it off nicely. But it's one of those things where, yeah, you can use a machine, more likely to have some sort of slippage. But you know, it doesn't take that long. I mean, half an hour to do some file work isn't in the grand scale of things isn't massive, is it?
Sure.
So just take your time and make sure your marking out is correct to begin with, and you should be good.
I got a follow-up question. Are you doing this with the steel hard, or are you doing it before you harden the steel?
I do it with the steel hard.
Okay.
It's a lot harder to do, obviously, but otherwise you're gonna have to get in there and clean it up anyway.
Right.
Because you're gonna when going through that whole process with heat treating, it's going to become mucky. So generally I do it hard, and I normally do it it's one of the last things that I do once the handle is on as well. Just so you can have a complete visual how it's going to be. I do it hard with those little diamond files. I mean, you can get them on Amazon for sort of 10, 12 pounds a packet of 5 or 6. I only generally use the 2 in the packet, which is the triangular one to start off with.
And the round one.
And the round one. That's basically it. But mine are very, very basic.
Yeah.
I mean, Jeff does some more, I think he calls it the dragon's tail or something like that.
Sure.
Some more intricate ones. But again, looking at those, it looks as if he's using just a triangular and a round one anyway. You get an oval one as well, which just makes that roundness a bit thicker. But yeah, just take your time, and as long as your marking out is good, I can't really see how you can go wrong.
Sure. I have another actual follow-up. Do you think there's any potential risk of doing the file work before hardening the blade?
It's always going to be on the spine anyway.
Right.
Your spine is always going to be sort of full thickness, really. So you're not, that spine isn't going to be super, super thin. If there were to be cracks or anything like that at all, it would probably start at where you've done the file, because
sure.
It's the thinnest point, point of least resistance. But I think because you're doing the spine, probably not so much. And, especially if you're doing it controlled in something like an even heat anyway,
mm-hmm.
I doubt it very much. But
okay.
But I don't know. I don't know. I always do it hardened, so I can see the finished thing, and then I add this as sort of an extra at the end.
Yeah.
Just so when it comes to your measurements and where you're marking out, I generally mark from a certain point off the top of the handle. Whereas if you do that beforehand, you're always sort of hoping to get your handle in the right place.
Gotcha. I was trying to play devil's advocate a little bit there. Yeah, I would definitely do it after heat treat as well. One, for the potential risk of, you don't want to go through all this work to prepare a blade for heat treat and do all this file work while the tang is soft. And then that file were cause of crack in the final heat treated product afterward. And so, yeah, that's why I would also try to do the file work after it's been heat treated. I also, when I do a non-integral full tang, I taper my tang. And if I did any file work before that, or I want to do the tang tapering after it's been hardened, because that gives you a little bit of wiggle room for figuring out like straightness. And sometimes you can grind things straight a little bit. And so I would do my tang tapering after the blade has been hardened. And if I did any file work beforehand and then tapered the tang after the hardening, it would mess up the file work. It would just wouldn't look the same. So I'd have to get back in there and do it anyways. I have all these questions because I've never actually done any file work. If you were to use rotary tools, are you using like what kind of cutting? Are you using like the sanding rotary tool bits, or are you using diamond, or are you using like carbide rotary bits for cutting any kind of channels?
I've tried both. Okay. So one is almost like a ceramic, mm-hmm. And it's like a cone shape.
Yeah.
So it gets thinner towards the edge. But as I said, the biggest problem really is it's going to want to skate off down the spine of the knife anyway. I suppose you could make some sort of jig and lower it down as you would with like a bandsaw. Mm-hmm. You know, you lower it down that way. And I've also tried it with carbide ones as well. But again, it's just always that same problem where, to be honest, it's not that much work. It really isn't. I said within half an hour, I generally, you know, and mine are very, to be clear, mine are very, very simple anyway. Just four or five sort of scallops each side. Mm-hmm. Trailing down. What I haven't seen, actually, I'm just thinking of it now. I think Jeff did it once or twice, is once you've done the file work, flood it with a colored epoxy.
Oh, sure.
And then sand back to the, you know, the original dimensions of the knife.
Yeah.
Using different colors. I think you could get something really cool looking there.
Yeah.
And I've always thought, wouldn't it be great if like a grinder manufacturer could make an attachment where that small wheel was so small. But I think the problem you've got is it would need to be, it would almost be needle-like.
Yeah.
By the time you put your belt on there, it would be spinning at such a speed because, you know, the smaller you get, obviously the quicker it needs to spin.
Yeah, it'd be tricky. I think because once you get so small, it's a lot of tension on that small arbor of that.
Yeah,
especially if you got down to like an eighth of an inch. Probably the best move would be to use a waterfall platen approach of some sort. And then have a little eighth inch piece of flat steel that's had the end rounded off like it was a wheel, but that would give the belt, and you wouldn't want to run full tension. You'd want the tension off just so that it's not putting so much stress on the belt, but that would allow the belt to slide around. But you'd have to be able to like stick it out there pretty away from whatever bottom wheel is helping to pull the belt away so that you could get in there and do that. But yeah, I think that's a potential approach for sure.
There's a challenge for the Broadbeck guys. So if you've got a Broadbeck, I'm sure you're aware of all the various tools and arms that you can buy. And you can do most things now on a Broadbeck. There's a challenge for the guys, if you're listening. Some sort of tool to help with firework. There we go.
Mm-hmm.
What would you use your Broadbeck for? Marek, I know you've got lots of tooling arms and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, actually, honestly, I was just using the Mareko platen on my Broadbeck.
Ooh,
it's named after me. Because I like to work my handles symmetrically, but to sculpt this guard, I had to actually put the heel of the handle towards the machine while getting underneath the guard and swirling around on both sides. And if I didn't have that extra depth, the handle would have been hitting either the platen arm or the actual arm or part of the body of the platen, like the plate that holds the idle wheels and everything. So I'm very thankful that it had that extra depth to get back behind it. But I also use it for sharpening. So with the hard platen, I start my sharpening with belts, and then and this is when I'm doing kind of like my commercial sharpening. And then if I'm doing a serrated blade, I'll use a buffing wheel with black compound on the buffing arm attachment to get into those serrations and clean those up and buff those out. Because otherwise it's kind of hard to get in there and do those things. It's a great machine. And again, it's a grinder built by knife makers for knife makers, but it's also great for woodworkers, other metal fabricators, crafty people in general, because it's just having a belt grinder like the Broadbeck is just such a handy tool to have around. And they have multitudes of attachments and platens and cool chillers and all kinds of stuff to get your grinding work done. They also sell a leather sewing machine, surface grinding attachments. So if you go to broadbeckironworks.com, you put in, I believe it's Knife Talk or Knife Talk 10, Craig.
I don't know. Okay. Try one of them, Knife Talk or Knife Talk 10.
And then, yeah, but make sure you put it in at checkout so that you can get that discount and save. I'm going to look it up and I'll probably interject later on with that discount. But yeah, those guys are really trying to take care of our community. They do a lot to help us out. And they're good dudes in general. I love seeing them and connecting with them. So yeah, it is Knife Talk 10. And you'll save your 10% off when you go to checkout and put in Knife Talk 10 at checkout.
Awesome. Okay. JP Knife Company or JP Knife Co. on Instagram. And by the way, all these people, they've sent these questions via Instagram. We are Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram. DM us those questions and we can just add them to the list. So he's got a question and he's got some self-sabotage too. So hey guys, got a question and a self-sabotage. Both from being very new to the trade. Okay. He's got a question. After every design I make, I always feel like there are similarities to other knives I've seen or that other people have made. Is this a problem and is there any way around this? So let's tackle that one first, then we'll head to his self-sabotage.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, it's one of those things. I think particularly if you're just starting out as well, you're probably taking so much inspiration from others just because that's what anybody does when they start something new. They try to see what's out there. So it is always a problem. But I think it's all about intent. As long as you're not intentionally going out to rip off somebody's design, I think you're good. And I think, you've said that you're new to the trade. The more styles that you can try, the better, I think. I really do. And see what fits you. And eventually you're going to come to your own sort of style and, how you like working. And that could be limited to the tools that you have, which I know is part of the next part of the question here. Could well be limited to the tools that you have or just as simple as the people that you follow online and seeing their work as well. So I think it's all about intent. If you're not intentionally going out there and ripping somebody off, good. If you're just... you're just testing the waters and you're trying out different things. It's all good. I think the more you do that, the better.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it's just part of the natural progression, especially if you spend any time online and you're already interested in knives and already see a lot of knives. It's hard not to be influenced or inspired by other people's work, unless you're like out in the middle of woods, living like a mountain man, completely disconnected and off grid. It's hard to not, and even still, there are knives out in the world that exist. And it's hard to not be influenced by those styles and shapes. I think like Craig was saying, you just be like super clear about what you're doing and that you're new. And honestly, I'm surprised I don't see more newer makers tagging other makers whose work theirs might have either taken inspiration from consciously or unconsciously. But when you look at the piece at the end or you share it with somebody and somebody says, oh, that reminds me of so-and-so's style work, you'd be like, oh shit, you know what? I see that now. It doesn't hurt you, honestly, to tag that person and be like, so after you, this is my knife, blah, blah, blah. It's definitely has some influence from Don Nguyen. He's always been an inspiration of mine and just adding that. And, especially as a new maker, the hardest part is to not only to set yourself apart and develop your own style, but also just to create awareness of you as a brand, as a maker. And by having that level of transparency and creating kind of like this sense of, trustworthiness, not only amongst your potential clients and customers, but amongst other makers, because other makers are going to help promote you. Honestly, that's how I got before I was on Joe Rogan or any of that. Like a lot of my growth came through other makers sharing my work to other makers or friends and stuff like that. And and then them sharing it back out. And so I've when I've seen somebody do like my style and tag me in it, whether it's Damascus or whether it's that overall style, their handle or whatever, I sometimes, if especially if I really like it or think it's a good, somebody has done a good job, because I know it's hard, I'll share it back out. And like that helps that kind of cross promotional quality of social media, being able to tag people, is a great way to help with your own growth. But I think eventually, like, the overall journey is eventually to develop your own style, but you pick it up here and there. I mean, we've talked about this before, like artists, when they're going to school, like art school and all that stuff, like they practice the techniques and the styles of noted masters of the past to develop all these various techniques that are really important and kind of fundamental. But eventually a person develops their own style, and whether it's a funky amalgamation of all these different artists, or they discover something new of their own or develop something new of their own, whatever it is, you'll figure it out somewhere down the road. And honestly, it, for me, some of the stylistic choices have been a result of the limitation of my own tooling, but instead of seeing them as a problem, I figured out how to make them work for me and then adapt it to the way I make my knives and the style or the profile or the whatever I'm doing with my work, to make it my own.
Yeah, that falls into, I mean, the second part of this, he's talked about self-sabotage.
Okay.
He says, somehow I always convince myself that I need all the right tools before I start making knives, and it really holds me back. I think you could use that, but I mean, I'm a massive example of that, to be honest with you. I always think, if I had this, I'd be so much better, you know. But you can use that to your advantage. I mean, look at the tools you've got, and you know, almost, how can I use these specifically to make what I need? Mm-hmm. Especially if you're just starting out, you're going to learn to use that tool so much better than if you've got a bunch of other tools. Whereas quite often, if you've got a bunch of tools, one tool you'd use for one particular task, but if you're limited in the amount of tools you've got, you're going to learn to use those tools as much as you possibly can, and you can become, you know, great at using that tool, and you're going to be creative in how you use it. So sometimes that limitation can actually be a good thing, but you know, there are basic things that everybody's going to need, unfortunately. I say everybody. I mean, we've all seen great examples of people just using a hand file,
sure,
and using a forge and making great, great knives.
Yeah.
But we all know, if you've got a grinder and if you've got a good kiln oven, it's going to make things so much easier for you, so much more consistent.
Right.
But once you've got them, I mean, the rest, you've all the heavy lifting's done for you there. Things like drill presses, things like that. You know, they'll come in time. But yeah, once you've got the main things that you need, there's nothing stopping you from creating, you know, what Mareko creates or what Jeff creates.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I have a very simple setup, and I could see, honestly, like there's definitely a element of the grass is greener, or you're feeling like, you know, there's just all these cool tools out there. But the reality is, like, if you can make what limited resources you have available work for you, you can go, I keep saying honestly, I'm sorry, it keeps driving me nuts. I'm hearing myself and I'm like, shut the fuck up, idiot. you can work in a lot of different situations. You can go work with other people in their shops. And I'll use myself as an example. Because my setup is so simple, I don't have a milling machine. I don't have all these complicated jigs and stuff. I do everything freehand. It's not like a flex point or a pry point. It's just what I've done, always done. And like, I have a grinder, I have a drill press. And my drill press, honestly, is a shitty central machine benchtop drill press. It's nothing fancy. I have a heat treating kiln. That's fancy. I have a forging press for forging my Damascus. I have a forge for forging blades. But even if I wasn't making Damascus, if I was just doing stock removal, honestly, all I would need, I just did it again, is a grinder.
I'd prefer you tell the truth all the time anyway, Mareko. you don't have to make a stipulation. I'm telling the truth at this exact moment.
I would just need a grinder and a drill press.
Bullshit.
Seriously, that's all you need, and you make a great knife. I mean, honest, obviously you would need some glue, I guess, as well. But if you have Corby bolts and you have a really nice clean fit up, like some of our friends have, you don't need the glue. But yeah, you don't need a lot. It's learning how to make the tools you have available to you really work for you. And that's what I've done. And so because I work with such a limited setup, I can go to anybody's shop and I can get work done. And it creates that flexibility to be able to go and work with other people and teach them, or collaborate with them, or even go learn from them, because they definitely have this, at least the basic setup that I have myself, and then more. So I feel like it creates a lot of flexibility to not rely on too many things, to try to have actually a little bit more of a simpler setup so that you don't need a lot, really.
An example of that, I mean, I haven't seen it, but Jeff has talked multiple times about the way Marekka will use his grinder. And he uses that in so many different ways. He uses every spot on that grinder to do different tasks. Yeah. That's one of those things. If you don't have other stuff, you need to learn to use the tools you've got to the full advantage.
Right.
Okay, with that, I'm going to tell you where you can buy shit. If you need to buy loads of shit, you can go to maritimeknifesupply.com. And unfortunately, we do need to buy stuff. Yeah. We need abrasives. We need all that kind
Absolutely.
Of stuff. Steel, handle materials, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, Lawrence has got it all. MaritimeKnifeSupply.com. It's your one-stop shop, really, for steel belts, handle materials, tools, forges, kilns, and more. They're also the Canadian distributor for combat abrasives as well. And they also sell Rhino Wet and Rhino Stick. And basically, everything we mention on the show, Lawrence will get in stock. So the MaritimeKnifeSupply.com. They've always got a deal where if you buy a 10-pack of belts, you get 10% off. But honestly, go follow him on Instagram as well, which is Maritime Knife Supply, because he's always getting new stock in, like interesting things. So it's definitely worth following, and he really is a good dude.
I just saw while he was down in Texas for the Texas Blade Show that he, I don't know if it was before, during, or after, but he made his way to a rifle range and did some shooting. And it made me think of you, Craig. If you ever come to the States, are you going to get to a gun range somewhere and just blast off a bunch of guns? Have you shot any guns?
I doubt it. I haven't. No. I don't think it would be my thing, to be honest with you.
You got to at least try it once.
I think Europeans and Americans have such different opinions on guns because it's just part of your culture.
Right.
Whereas, I mean...
We're motherfucking cowboys, baby.
I say it's not, but actually where I am... they do when it's hunt season, everybody's fucking shooting all the time. But because they're hardcore farmers around here and hunters. But yeah, it's just something that, okay, I grew up in the UK, and it's just something that we're just not exposed to at all.
Sure.
At all. So I really don't have an interest in it, strangely, which I'm sure lots of Americans are just like, hey, man, you know, I'm just like, it's just something that it's not part of my culture, I suppose.
Yeah. For me, it's kind of like... It's the marksmanship quality to it that I really enjoy, and the challenge of the marksmanship aspect. I don't really care about like the big boom guns or I guess boom sticks or little 22s.
Big AK-47.
Yeah, I don't care about the size of the thing. Obviously, you can make bigger shit blow up or be destroyed with bigger guns, but for me, I always enjoy the marksmanship aspect of it. And yeah. I really like it for that. But I don't really do it very often.
Is it just like going to a golf range? You just pay and you just go there and you can just...
Yeah, you can. Yeah, and you can... You have your own stuff, you can bring your own stuff, usually. Otherwise, they have stuff on loan. You pay for ammunition and they have a range. My father-in-law actually goes to a what's called a skeet shooting range. Shooting the skeet, and it's shotgun, and it's pump action shotgun, and they're just and they're throwing clay pigeons left and right and all over the place, and that's probably what I've done the most over the last whatever 20 years, and the most
that does look fun.
The most
that does
meaning
look fun,
like man. Going twice, but it was super fun. I fucking loved it. Anyways, if you come to the States, we got to get you on a range. Just
go shooting, rootin' tootin',
shooting. We'll get you a big old Yosemite Sam hat, and it'll be good.
Nice. Nice. Let me tell everybody about Dharmasteel before we head off, because we've worked with Dharmasteel for a number of years now. They make the highest quality stainless steel Damascus. Patterns, they're beautiful. And if you look online, you can actually see their patterns as well. They're always introducing new patterns. Work to a really, really high tolerance. Really, really good people. We work with them on the Chef Invitational every year as well, which is always a good example, for a good way for us, rather, to see examples of people's work with Dharmasteel. And people are making some amazing stuff. So I think we've had a number of questions today from people who haven't really been making knives that long. And I'd say if you want to make something special and level up almost instantly, try using a piece of Dharmasteel.
Yeah.
We were surprised when we did the Chef Invitational, talking to various makers who are using Dharmasteel, how easy they found it to use. And they've got this whole section on their website of how to, you know, heat treat and all the rest of it. So dharmasteel.se, they're dharmasteelab on Instagram. Go take a look, because people are making some really, really beautiful, beautiful stuff with it. You can get a discount. If you use Knife Talk at checkout, you'll get 10% off your order at Dharmasteel as well. So go take a look. And I believe, going back to Maritime Knife Supply, I believe they're supplying Dharmasteel now
they
as
are,
well.
Yeah.
And we've got some news coming up very, very, very soon about the next build along, where we're partnering with both Maritime Knife Supply and Dharmasteel to supply that steel. Because we had a bit of a problem last time we did the build along, where people just basically couldn't get it in time, you know, because Dharmasteel they're based in Sweden, and we have a lot of, you know, US based people listen to the show, so it's a bit of a struggle them getting it. So working with Lawrence, there it should be good, and we should get some great build alongs again. So I'm looking forward to that. Yeah. Shall we call it a day?
Let's call it a day.
We've done a bit of both. We've done a bit. I think Jeff's been quite quite clever with the questions he put up today. He's put up lots of, hey, I'm new to knife making. He's like, Craig will handle them. And then a lot of the, hey, I'm doing Damascus, what do you think?
Sure.
And that one's from Reco. Yeah. So again, Jeff, thank you very much for all the hard work you put on the show. We hope those plugs are taken. that you can have a full, thick set of... set of hair, a full thick mane that we'll be seeing in months to come. So keep sharing those Instagrams so we can see that hair growing. And it's very brave of you to share that journey with us. Thank you very much. Thank you all for listening, and we shall speak to you all again next week. Bye for now.
This show is brought.
There we go. That wasn't too bad.
I kept trying to think of how to make it a joke about it actually being pubic hair that he was having replaced, and I couldn't
cultivating think. Pubic hair.
He's actually pulling hair from his head down to his little head.
Jeez. Yeah. I think they take from the crack of your butt, I think they take the follicles of hair and they put it onto your scalp, because people wouldn't see that anywhere. But seriously, I've just this week I've seen 4 or 5 people that I know who are getting hair transplants, and they're like sharing the journey completely. And I remember, imagine like 10 years ago, somebody said, you know, blokes are going to be having sort of cosmetic surgery and sharing their journey, like quite proudly. You would just be like, what? Really?
Sure.
It's mad. But it's just a common thing now. It's crazy.
Good for them.
Good for them. Exactly. Yeah.
You watch anything interesting lately?
No. We've just been flat out, really, with the kids. And what have we been watching?
Have you seen previews for that new series called Regime with Kate Winslet?
No.
She's like this crazy, like, dictator lady. And she, like, her general... is like becomes her lover, and they're just like both fucking psychopaths, it looks like. I've only seen the preview, and they just start like going crazy.
She's great.
She's
awesome. She's
great. I love her.
There was something a couple of years ago that she was like the sheriff of some sort of Canadian town. It was very much like Fargo. It was set. It was all very much like that. And it was brilliant. What was it? I think it was called The Sheriff of whatever town it was. I think it was on Apple TV. And she's great in that. Really, really good. I think she's brilliant. Yeah. But no, I'll have to look out for that one.
I started watching Sopranos for the first time.
That's one of those things I've never ever watched. I know people love it.
Yeah, I know people love it too. I was always, I don't know, I've always been very when something has like mass enjoyment, I'm like, it's probably not that good.
I'm the same. Yeah, it's weird. As if like, oh, especially if I'm late to the party, then I'm just like, oh, I'm not interested, you know?
Yeah. But I started watching it, and it's fucking good. I'm in the middle of the third season right now, and I'm really enjoying it a lot. And I think for you, it would definitely help your New York accent, for sure. Except for a lot of the guys are from New Jersey. It's based around a mob family in New Jersey. But
New Jersey.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good, though.
So that's going to be 20 years old now, is it, maybe?
Oh, God, yeah, at least.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I tell you what I did try to watch the other day, just because it's been force-fed down me at the moment every time I open Netflix. They put all Seinfelds on.
Oh, nice.
So I started, and I'm just like, oh, maybe it's just because they're older. I was just like, I don't find this funny.
Really?
I just found it really, really bland. It was just like, oh, right, okay. I don't see what the fuss is. But maybe, you know, it's out of context now because times have moved on. Maybe I don't know.
You've never seen any of them before?
Never seen any of them. And I watched maybe four or five the other day, and I was just like, oh, I don't.
Yeah, the first ones are kind of slow. I remember going back and watching those because a friend of mine loved them so much. He has like the box set of all the DVDs of all the seasons. And I was rewatching the first ones. And I'm like, oh, these are kind of boring.
But
they do eventually, like, they start building up, and then the stories come around full circle, and they keep picking up and dropping. I don't know, like, they.
Right, I suppose you get used to the characters then. Yeah.
I think that first season might be a little bit of a slog, but I think for me, when I watch it, it's somewhat nostalgic too, because like I started watching it when I was in middle school or something like that, when I was like 12, 13 years old. And and so when I watch it now, I remember, it's like some of this remembrance of this funny stuff, but also like getting so much more out of it now that I wasn't getting then. I was just like, holy shit.
Yeah, makes sense.
It's none of it was ever I never picked up in the first season. I was probably like the fourth or fifth season or something when I first started watching it.
Sorry, go on. Just find it bland. Just bland, I suppose.
The show you were talking about where she's the sheriff is called Mayor of Easttown.
That's the one. It's brilliant. Easton. Very, very good. If you haven't seen it, definitely worth watching.
Yeah. Yeah, she's great.
Okay, cool. Let's leave it at that, and we shall be back hopefully with a full party, three of us.
Absolutely.
Next week. Right. Thank you all for listening. Bye.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.